And so that's what I'll do, although the first slide says confessional subscription among 17th century particular Baptists. I think it's difficult to distinguish between the two because how they viewed their commitment to confessions of faith really explains the nature of confessionalism among them. Now, one of the questions that we ought to ask by way of introduction to this session is, what is the historic Baptist position on confessionalism? How have Baptists viewed the place, the role, the function of confessions of faith in their churches and in their lives? And I want to give you three examples of how Baptists present themselves or present confessions in relationship to themselves. One from the middle of the 19th century, one from the beginning of the 20th century, and one towards the end of the 20th century. It's very interesting to hear from these three authors. The first, E.B. Underhill, writing in the middle of the 19th century, and he published a volume supported by the Hansard Knowles Society. There was a series of volumes, but this one was called Baptist Confessions of Faith. And Underhill says this: "The confessions of this volume were not creeds compulsorily imposed on the members or churches of the Baptist body. Speaking strictly, they were apologies taking the form of confessions or creeds as the most convenient way of informing adversaries of the matter of their faith. No one was required or bound to subscribe to them, and if adopted by any church as the expression of its sentiments, all others were left free, and even a considerable latitude of judgment allowed in the bosom of the church itself. They originated in the false accusations, the calumnies, and misrepresentations of foes. They were not framed to procure unity among the churches that accepted them. They sought to reflect the existing harmony of sentiment and the scriptural orthodoxy of the communities whose pastors signed them. They left the phantom of uniformity to the unavailing search of an establishment." That's pretty interesting, isn't it? Writing in the middle of the 19th century, Underhill says that they were not, and no one was required to subscribe. Thanks, brother. And there was light, and it was good. Especially for old eyes. No one was required to subscribe, but he says, even within the churches that adopted confessions, there was a considerable latitude of judgment allowed. Meaning among the membership, you could have differences of opinion on matters that were expressed in the church's confession of faith. That's his view in the middle of the 19th century. I was trying on my feet to come up with an illustration of what this was. It's sort of like the confession of faith is just a portrait that's put on the wall, and you walk by and you say, oh, that looks nice, but it doesn't have any real influence on the life of the family. It's just there. And that's what it seems that Underhill is saying. Now, we move up to the beginning of the 20th century. In another book entitled Baptist Confessions of Faith by William McLaughlin, who taught at Southern Seminary about 100 years ago. He says this in his introduction: "Being congregational and democratic in church government, Baptists have naturally been very free in making, changing, and using confessions. There has never been among them any ecclesiastical authority which could impose a confession upon their churches or other bodies. Their confessions are, strictly speaking, statements of what a certain group of Baptists, large or small, did believe at a given time, rather than a creed which any Baptist must believe at all times in order to hold ecclesiastical position or be considered a Baptist. In the latter sense, there has been no Baptist creed. Churches at their constitution have made their own confessions, adopted an old one in its original or in a modified form, or as in the case of the First Baptist Church of Providence, Rhode Island, the oldest Baptist church in America, have had no doctrinal statement whatever. No creed but the Bible. I think we heard about that this morning. That comes from about 100 years ago, very similar to what Underhill said in the 19th century. And then late in the 20th century, William Lumpkin, who took McLaughlin's book, Baptist Confessions of Faith, and updated it, also weighs in on the subject. Now, this is not from the preface of Baptist Confessions of Faith. This is rather from an article on Baptist affirmations about the doctrine of Scripture. And the article argues that Baptists have always been free to have differences of opinion on what Scripture is and how Scripture functions in the life of the church. But in that article, he addresses the question of confessions. He says this: their confessions, meaning Baptist confessions of faith, are a primary source of information regarding the views of Baptists in particular eras. Indeed, it has been contended that the single practical value of confessions is their recording historic viewpoints and reflecting periodic consensus. Because Baptists have steadfastly refused to elevate their confessions into creeds, the documents have been denied the status of permanently binding pronouncements, but they possess nevertheless the dignity of historic conclusions of the past with regard to understandings and intimations of Scripture. That's interesting. You read a confession of faith just so that you can have a window into the views of those who propose that confession of faith at whatever point in time. Once again, it's like a snapshot. And this snapshot tells you what theological life was like then, but it doesn't really have any influence today. I guess this would be sort of like us going through the photo albums of our grandparents, if they had photo albums, and seeing the quaintness of life when our grandparents were alive, but it doesn't really have anything to do with us because we look at it and say, boy, I'm glad I live today, and we have flush toilets and showers and toothbrushes and all the rest. In a sense, that's what they're doing. Now, if we were to continue to multiply these examples, I would say to you, this is the common party line. This is typically what you will find in literature of Baptists as they examine confessions. They say, they're nice, but. And it becomes sort of like an echo chamber, where one person has said it, and someone else repeats it, and someone else repeats it, and because it's a scholar of note, or someone with a PhD behind his name, or a faculty member at a well-known school, then it must be true. You see, that must be the way that it is. Baptists have never used confessions like creeds. They've never been, for believers, a standard that has to be followed. But I want to argue that this line, though it is the common party line, is really the result of the Enlightenment, or what Rich Barcelos very cleverly calls the endarkenment. That century-long intellectual event, beginning in Europe and coming to the New World, in which old ways of thinking, old philosophical presuppositions were turned away, and a new form of approach that focused on the individual won the day. I want to challenge this idea that is so commonly proposed by scholars, even Baptist scholars today. And I want to suggest to you that in the 17th century, and also in the 18th century, prior to or concurrent with some of the influences of the Enlightenment, Baptists held a very different view of the position of confessions of faith. Now, the way that I want to do this is by working our way through some primary source material. When you do historical work, there are two categories, typically, that literature may be placed into. On the one hand, there's primary sources. And primary sources are pieces of literature, books or letters or manuscripts, anything that comes from the original participants. And that's the best source that you want when doing historical work. The other kind is secondary sources. And secondary sources are just what they sound like. They're the reflections and opinions of others upon what has happened before them. So I'm a secondary source when I'm talking about the 17th century, where the 17th century writers are primary sources, all right? So I'm the secondary source, they're the primary source. I want to take you to the primary sources. Now, I think all of them except I've got two shots here in the PowerPoint that are from the 17th century itself. All of the rest have been transcribed so that you can see them. But if you need me to prove it from the primary sources, I can do that, okay? I won't say, trust me, although you probably do. But if you don't trust me, I won't be offended, and I'll point you to where you can find this stuff originally, okay? So here we go. Let's look at some of the primary sources. And the place that I want to begin is with our own confession of faith. This is a representation of the original title page, a confession of faith put forth by the elders and brethren of many congregations of Christians baptized upon profession of their faith in London and the country. And remember the story we told yesterday about Thomas Collier being out in the country and the controversy and the meetings that were held in the country in Bristol and out in the West? That's the country that's being referred to here. You had London, you had the Bristol and the Western churches coming together to form this confession of faith in order that they might oppose the errors and the misrepresentations that Thomas Collier was promoting and that others were perhaps imputing to them as well. And you can see at the bottom, printed in the year 1677. It's interesting that there's something missing here. And what's missing is the name of a printer. But that's because 1677 was a year in which it was very dangerous to publish things that were not approved by the leaders of the Anglican, the Episcopal Church in England. And so this was illegally published and anonymously published so as not to identify either the printer or any of the churches, although I don't think it would take much on the part of an inquisitor to find out who was behind the confession of faith. You saw this sign, this slide yesterday. We repeat it again. I think we can have the lights off now, Jack or Jared or somebody. It might be easier to see. The first literary reference to our confession of faith, August the 26th, 1677, in the Petit France church book, the church there in London, it was agreed that a confession of faith with the appendix thereto, having been read and considered by the brethren, should be published. This is just a month after the final exhortation that was given to Thomas Collier, and it appears. By every circumstantial piece of evidence that we have, it probably originated in the Petit France Church. It was the largest church in London, one of the oldest churches. In this period, they had about 500 members, 12 deacons, two pastors. Cox and Collins were the two men. And so it seems that they were the ones who were primarily responsible for the publication of the confession, although it was published in the name of many others. Now, it is prefaced by this piece of work that I called yesterday, I said yesterday, ought to be printed every time that the confession is printed. This ought to be incorporated with it. It troubles me that many of the brief paperback editions of the confession that have been published in the last 40 years just take the text of the confession and neglect the epistle at the beginning and the appendix at the end. I want to read through some of this for you. It's a little bit more than what we saw yesterday. But I want you to pay attention to the kind of language that they use. Remember, this is to the judicious and impartial reader. My son Sam, sometimes when he quotes others on the internet, he will say, a judicious and impartial reader wrote to me saying blah, 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 blah. And usually it's me that's in the background, you know. That's what he calls me. But if you're a judicious and impartial reader who's willing to hear their voices, to give them the benefit of the doubt, to recognize that they're being truthful in what they say, these words take on a great deal of importance and meaning. So let's read through this and listen to their voice. Courteous reader. Sounds like Ann Landers or something, doesn't it? Dear Abby, yeah. Courteous reader. It is now many years since diverse of us, with other sober Christians then living and walking in the way of the Lord that we profess, did conceive ourselves to be under a necessity of publishing a confession of our faith for the information and satisfaction of those that did thoroughly understand, that did not thoroughly understand, it says throughly, but it's thoroughly, understand what our principles were, or had entertained prejudices against our profession by reason of the strange representation of them by some men of note, who had taken very wrong measures and accordingly led others into misapprehensions of us and them. Now that was Daniel Featley. You didn't hear me say the name yesterday, Thomas Edwards, who wrote, published a very famous series of books called Gangrena. Now, you know what gangrene is. He viewed all of the sects, as people that he called sects, in England as the gangrene of England that need to be cut off. In fact, he's nicknamed Thomas Gangrena Edwards. Gangrena Edwards makes reference to the Baptists, the early Baptists in that statement. So you have men like Featley, men like Gangrena Edwards. That's what's in the background here. Picking it up, and this was first put forth about the year 1643 in the name of seven congregations then gathered in London. Since which time, diverse impressions thereof have been dispersed abroad, and our end proposed in good measure answered, inasmuch as many, and some of those eminent, both for piety and learning, were thereby satisfied that we were no way guilty of those heterodoxies and fundamental errors which had too frequently been charged upon us without ground or occasion given on our part. Remember the story of Munster and how Featley used that story of Munster to say, let King Charles and Parliament be warned, a brilliant piece of propaganda, that what happened in Munster could happen in London as well. That's what they're responding to here. That's what they're concerned about. So they publish this confession of faith for the purpose of defending themselves, apologizing for themselves, helping others to understand that they were sound Christians. And for as much as that confession is not now commonly to be had, and also that many others have since embraced the same truth which is owned therein, it was judged necessary by us to join together in giving a testimony to the world of our firm adhering. Now notice the language that they're using, okay? Not of our general consent with, not of our appreciation for, but our firm adhering to those wholesome principles by the publication of this, which is now in your hand. Now, this is the first sentence that gives us an indication of the intention of the publication of the Second London Confession. Okay? Firm adhering to the wholesome principles. Dr. Fesco told us this morning how much there is in common between Westminster Confession, Savoy Declaration, Second London Confession. They belong to the same family. Our firm adhering to the wholesome principles by the publication of this, which you now hold in your hand. Imagine you're sitting there in a timbered room with a fire going in the fireplace, and you're trying to read this little pamphlet that has been put into your hand, and you're taking seriously what they say. Okay, they're telling me that they firmly adhere to this. And that's our first clue. And for as much as our method and manner of expressing our sentiments in this doth vary from the former, that is the First London Confession, although the substance of the matter is the same. Remember what we saw yesterday, how they argue that the two confessions hold to the same doctrines. And I argued that Second London, Todd Gill gave me the word, orthodoxification. It makes the First Confession orthodox. We shall freely impart to you the reason and occasion thereof. One thing that greatly prevailed with us to undertake this work was not only to give a full account of ourselves to those Christians that differ from us about the subject of baptism, but also the profit that might from thence arise unto those that have any account of our labors in their instruction and establishment in the great truths of the gospel. They see the practical benefit of publishing this. In the clear understanding and steady belief of which, Our comfortable walking with God and fruitfulness before Him in all our ways is most nearly concerned. And therefore, we did conclude it necessary to express ourselves the more fully and distinctly. This is the apology for why the second confession differs in its expression from the first confession. And also to fix on such a method as might be most comprehensive of those things which we designed to explain our sense and belief of. And finding no defect in this regard, and that fixed on by the assembly, we explained that yesterday, and after them by those of the congregational way, we did readily conclude it best to retain the same order in our present confession. And also, when we observed that those last mentioned, the Savoyans, did in their confession, for reasons which seemed of weight both to themselves and others, choose not only to express their mind in words concurrent with the former, with the assembly, in sense, concerning all those articles wherein they were agreed, but also for the most part without any variation of the terms, we did in like manner conclude it best to follow their example in making use of the very same words with them both in these articles, which are very many, wherein our faith and doctrine is the same with theirs. And this we did the more abundantly to manifest our consent with both in all fundamental articles of the Christian religion, as also with many others whose orthodox confessions have been published to the world on the behalf of the Protestants in diverse nations and cities. Now, there's something that you need to take away from this statement, and it's this. One of the frustrations that I had in doing my doctoral work and then studying a particular Baptist afterwards is a fairly limited range of topics that they address in their published books. A lot of what they write is about baptism. It's about covenant theology. That's primarily what you get, and the doctrine of the church. But you don't get a lot else. And for a while I was frustrated by that, because I wanted to know what they thought about Christology or the doctrine of God or soteriology. But this helps me to understand why there isn't. Because what they're saying is, when we share the same language, you can go off to the writings of, name somebody, Thomas Manton, Thomas Watson, John Owen, any of the others, go off to them and read what they say, because they say what we say. Or maybe I should put it the opposite way. We say what they say. We hear them. We agree with them. So there wasn't any need on the part of the Baptists to spend their time writing new books. They could simply say, go read this. Those of you who have seen the Cox-Owen volume that we did 15 or 20 years ago, Cox put together a work on the covenants that God made with men before the giving of the law at Sinai. And in the preface to that, he says, I had gathered some material for a further work, a volume 2, but am happily prevented by the recent appearance of Dr. Owen on Hebrews chapter 8. So here's a Baptist sending his readers off to a congregational pedo-Baptist to learn about covenant theology. Because he says, what Owen believes is what we believe. I find that really refreshing. I find that very helpful. And that's the point that they're making. We have this in common. And so we're committed to it. They're the fundamental articles of the Christian religion expressed in confessions in different nations and in different cities. You get this sense of commonality, of confessionalism that pertains across the board in Europe. And also to convince all that we have no itch to clog religion with new words, but to readily acquiesce in that form of sound words which hath been in consent with the Holy Scriptures, okay, there's the Bible, used by others before us. Now the reason I asked Dave to read from 1 Timothy 6 is right here. When Paul charges Timothy to make the good confession, I realize he's not talking about writing a confession of faith, okay? I'm not making that linguistic mistake. And it wasn't really the use of the word confession that interested me. It was the fact that he charged Timothy before God and Christ. It's the solemnity of the language. Well, that's what they use here. Hereby declaring. Let's put the full weight of words here. And treat these men as if they're honest in what they're saying. Hereby declaring before God, angels, and men our hearty agreement with them in that wholesome Protestant doctrine, which with so clear evidence of scriptures they have asserted, that is, all the Reformed confessions in Europe and in England. We agree with them. God is our witness. It's no small thing to make a solemn declaration invoking the Lord in heaven and say, this is what we believe. Now, I'm building a case here. You won't find anything in the 17th century that says we have a high view of confessional subscription. But there's a whole lot of evidence put together that says, yes, we are committed to our confessions of faith. Let's keep reading. Some things indeed are in some places added, some terms omitted, some few changed, but these alterations are of that nature as that we need not doubt any charge or suspicion of unsoundness in the faith from any of our brethren upon account of them. Okay. Now that's the epistle to the judicious and impartial reader. And we'll see in a few moments another statement that was made in 1689 that supports this same idea. But you get the sense when you read this epistle that prefaces the Confession of Faith that these men are really serious about what they say. And they want their readers to understand how serious they are. We're not just presenting to you a portrait of the family, but we're saying, this is us and we're committed to it. And we ask the Lord to be our witness how much we are committed to what we're about to say. Now let's go back in time to the First London Confession of Faith and see what they say. Remember, we talked yesterday about how difficult and dangerous this situation was because those who opposed them were in power and they were trying to cast the worst kind of mud upon them, and there was the danger of prison or worse that might be brought against them. And so they write their confession of faith to identify themselves and show their commonalities. And this is some of the material that they say in their preface. We have, for the clearing of the truth, we profess that it may be at liberty, though we be in bonds, briefly published a confession of our faith as desiring all that fear God seriously consider whether, if they compare what we here say and confess in the presence of the Lord Jesus and his saints, men have not with their tongues in pulpit and pens in print. Now, they're probably here thinking especially of Gangrena Edwards. Was it Jeremiah Burroughs, I think it was, said something to the effect of he had never seen a man who professed godliness who was more ungodly in his speech than Thomas Gangrena Edwards was when he made reference to others. He was scandalized by the tone that Gangrena Edwards used towards other professing Christians. All right, so that's probably who he has in mind here. And because it may be conceived that what is here published may be the judgment of some one particular congregation more refined than the rest, meaning, you know, there's a leading congregation and they seem to have it together more than the others. Rather than that, we do therefore here subscribe it, some of each body in the name and by the appointment of seven congregations, who though we be distinct in respect of particular bodies, for conveniency's sake, being as many as can well meet together in one place, yet are all one in communion, holding Jesus Christ to be our head and Lord, subscribed in the name of the seven churches in London. Now, that's once again pretty strong language. Now, if we think through the circumstances that they're facing, they don't want to go to jail. They don't want to be punished. They don't want to endure persecution. And so they're seeking in every way possible to make an honest declaration to others. And that's why they use this kind of language, you see. It was very important for them to say, this really and truly is what we believe and what we're all about. Now let's fast forward for a moment. I have to tell you a story. Let me just hit this for a moment. That's a trick I learned about PowerPoint. If you hit B, it blanks the screen. Very convenient. In the 1690s, there was a very sad, difficult controversy in London that split the churches apart. And it was over the propriety of congregational singing. It's not a pleasant story to tell, and I don't have the time to tell the whole story. Some of the leading men ended up on different sides of this issue. And they showed their worst sides. They allowed their sinful natures to be evidenced in the way that they wrote about each other. They insulted each other. It's very sad. Benjamin Keach was the leader of the pro-singing side. And there were others who were leaders of the anti-singing side. To us, it seems like an obscure controversy because all of our churches sing. But they were opposed to this. Even psalms. Some men were against singing altogether in worship. They didn't believe that the regulative principle permitted singing. Well, this controversy went on, and Keach, who was one of the participants and one of the men who didn't bridle his tongue, or perhaps his pen, as well as he should, suggested, as he looked back to the First London Confession of Faith, that the early Baptists, the 1640s particular Baptists, did not believe that churches should provide support for their ministers. Okay, that's the charge that he makes. That in the 1640s, the churches didn't believe that pastors should be financially supported. Now, on the other side of the singing issue was William Kiffin. Now, Keach and Kiffin are two of the main leaders in London, and they're on opposite sides. And Kiffin, of course, had a memory that extended all the way back to the 1640s. He was one of the leaders and one of the participants in those seven churches. Keach was born in 1640, so he was in diapers when the 1644 confession was first published. But Kiffin was part of it. So Kiffin had living memory of what took place. And being on the other side of the singing controversy, Kiffin and others along with him went into print against Keach, and they wanted to demonstrate that Keach was wrong in this assertion that he had made. One of the end result of this was that Keach apologized, and Keach acknowledged that he had never actually seen a copy of the First London Confession before he made the charge. Because in the First London Confession of Faith, there is a clear statement about the importance of churches supporting ministers. So Keach made a big mistake here, and Kiffin and his fellow writers called him on it. Now, I want you to see how this works. They write, "Keach and his supporters," that's just my shorthand there, "exhibit a very grievous and a very false charge against those of the same profession that were more ancient in it than the authors of this reply who vent this scandal." Now, they're treating this charge that the early Baptists didn't believe in ministerial support as a scandal. "When those ancient brethren were convinced of their duty that believers upon confession of their faith were the only subjects of baptism and accordingly sat down together in communion as a congregation or church of Christ, and many in the nation began to inquire into the truth thereof, they met with many harsh censures and false charges cast upon them to make the truth of Christ contemptible, namely, that they were corrupt in the doctrines of the gospel, that they denied subjection to magistrates." These are the kinds of charges that Daniel Featley made. "That they held that to maintain," and maintain is the old word to financially support, "that they held that to maintain ministers was anti-Christian, etc. They, to clear themselves and to take off those false charges, did think it their duty to publish to the nation a confession of their faith." So this is talking about the First London, okay? "Which, when drawn up, was read in the churches, being then seven in number, and consented to by all the members, not one dissenting, and subscribed by two of each church in the name of the rest, which confession was five times printed in the year 1644, and from that to the year 1651, without the least alteration of any one article of what was last printed." Now, I struggle with that statement because I know that they revised it in 1646. And if they're referring to 1651, which was another minor revision, okay, it's true. If not, then it's mistaken. But we'll pass by that. Which confession gave such general satisfaction to most Christians of all sorts of differing persuasions from us that it took off from many that prejudice and offense that was formerly taken by them against our profession? And it is interesting that in the 1650s, some of the Baptists become prominent during the Commonwealth, and they're very much involved and recognized in the political process in England. What the judgment of these churches in their first constitution was concerning the maintenance of ministers may be seen in the 28th article in these words. We do believe that due maintenance of ministers should be the free and voluntary communication of the church, that according to Christ's ordinance, they that preach the gospel should live on the gospel, etc. All right, so you have a clear and a plain statement. Keach really messed up by asserting that the early Baptists didn't believe this. He was totally wrong. And accordingly, they did then, and we have ever since made it our practice as a duty required of all the members of the church that are able to give. Herein we would be understood in this, that we now assert concerning the churches that we mean principally as they were in the beginning, and we do find to our great grief that which was then falsely charged upon us by those that did not know us is now as falsely, with a far greater aggravation of their sin, charged upon us by some of us who might have satisfied themselves had they perused our confession of faith. Benjamin, if only you'd found a copy and looked at it, you'd know better. Now, here we go. To this charge we answer that nothing can be more falsely asserted or more slanderously uttered. And I put this in bold. For if this their charge have the least shadow of truth against the baptized churches in their first beginning here in England, they must needs be the grossest sort of hypocrites in professing the contrary by their profession of faith, and yet believing and practicing quite otherwise to what they solemnly professed as their faith in the matter. Wow. You see what they're saying? If they publicly declared that churches ought to be supporting their ministers and they didn't do it, look at the language. The grossest sort of hypocrites. The confession of faith was not viewed as a portrait on the wall. It was a living document. And to make this confession of faith your own is to say, this is what we believe and this is what we practice. And if you don't do so, you're a gross hypocrite. So what this means is seven churches in London and all of the members of all of the churches, no one dissenting, agreed and subscribed to the First London Confession in this sense. This is a most false accusation and slander against the baptized churches in their first gathering, laying that to their charge as a received principle owned by them, which they had openly declared against to the whole world in their confession of faith, which was in those days printed and published, whereby they stigmatize or brand them with the deepest hypocrisy that depraved mortals can be guilty of. If you make a religious statement, if you say, this is what we believe, and yet you don't really mean it, in their terms, you are guilty of the deepest hypocrisy that depraved mortals can be guilty of. We say, this is what we believe, but this is really what we're all about. Wow, this is really strong language. How did they view confessional subscription? That's how they viewed it. If you say it, you believe it. Don't say it if you don't believe it. Now back to the epistle of 1677. There is one thing more which we sincerely profess and earnestly desire credence in, namely, that contention is most remote from our design in all that we have done in this matter. And we hope the liberty of an ingenuous unfolding our principles, ingenuous, honest, and open, and opening our hearts unto our brethren with the scripture grounds on which our faith and practice leans, will by none of them be either denied to us or taken ill from us. Our whole design is accomplished if we may obtain that justice as to be measured in our principles and practice and the judgment of both by others, according to what we have now published, which the Lord, whose eyes are as a flame of fire, knoweth to be the doctrine, which with our hearts we most firmly believe and sincerely endeavor to conform our lives to." Now, the previous statements written in the 1690s used the language of hypocrisy. Here's some language that's written in the 1677. In 1677, it's very positive. But they once again invoke the name of the Lord, saying, honestly and openly before him, he knows that this is the doctrine that we are committed to and which we desire to conform ourselves unto. Now, they're saying probably here, we don't always meet the standard. We fail. We're sinners. But the Lord knows this is what we believe and this is our goal. And here's the famous words that were printed with the confession, printed with the 1689 General Assembly narrative when they adopted the Confession of Faith. "We, the ministers and messengers of and concerned for upwards of 100 baptized churches," there were 108, "in England and Wales, denying Arminianism, being met together in London from the 3rd of the 7th month to the 11th of the same 1689, to consider of some things that might be for the glory of God and the good of these congregations, have thought meet for the satisfaction of all other Christians that differ from us in the point of baptism, to recommend their perusal, to their perusal, the confession of our faith, which confession we own as containing the doctrine of our faith and practice, and do desire that the members of our churches respectively do furnish themselves therewith." Now, there's more evidence that I want to present to you, but I hope my case is starting to show. The language that they use is strong language. And let's not make the fallacy, the word fallacy, the word concept fallacy, where if the word isn't exactly what we expect it to be, then it isn't present. This is the language of confessional subscription. What they're saying is, we mean this when we say it. A couple more to mention. The Cripplegate Church in London. In the late 1690s, there was an attempt to revive the London Association after the split that took place. I will be going back to the screen in a minute. After the split that took place over the singing controversy and fellowship disintegrated, there was an attempt a few years later to bring the churches back together again, to reform the London Association. And the Cripplegate Church wouldn't participate. And this is from their church book. Here are the reasons that they give why they won't participate. "Some reasons why we did not send messengers to ye association that met at Joiners Hall the 25th of March last, nor to the previous meeting at Mr. Deering's coffee house on the 18th of the same. Humbly offered to the consideration of all those baptized churches which have or consign the confession of our faith printed in the year 1688 and recommended to the churches by the General Assembly that met at Broken Wharf in London in 1689. All right, so they're looking back. The confession was signed by the churches and it was adopted by the General Assembly. Because the solemn owning, now remember that word, which confession we own? Because the solemn owning and ratifying of our so well attested and generally approved confession of faith, as transmitted to us in the full evidence of that word by our late pastors, etc., in the General Assembly, seems to us, as it did also to them, a thing absolutely necessary to the just and regular constitution of all associations. But the admitting of the above said churches into association renders this altogether impracticable." There were two churches that were being welcomed in. One was a Seventh-day Baptist church who agreed on virtually everything else except the day of worship. And then there was another church, the Barbican Church, which was invited to participate. The Barbican Church didn't identify with either the Calvinistic Baptist or the Arminian Baptist. It tried to steer a middle way. And because of the friendships among the pastors, The Barbican Church was invited to join. So you have these particular Baptists, along with the Seventh-day Church and the Barbican Church, trying to form an association, and the Cripplegate people say no. And the reason we say no is that the solemnizing and ratifying of our confession of faith is not present. They continue, that it hath been the stated method of our associations, notice the bold, most religiously to own. Okay, as an act of faith, of religious practice. Most religiously to own, ye same confession is evident, for we find that ye association in London in 1644 subscribed in the name of the churches the confession then put forth, and also that association which met in 1652 did the same. And moreover, in the year 1656, the churches in Somerset, Devon, Dorset, Wiltshire, Gloucester, and Bristol met in association, put forth a confession of their faith agreeable with the former, on purpose that they might declare their harmony in faith and practice. Again, in the year 1677, the elders and brethren of many churches in London and the country unanimously put forth our present confession of faith, which was approved of and signed by the General Assembly, which met in 1689, which General Assembly thought fit at the time to let all the churches know that they denied Arminianism and that they hold that good old Orthodox doctrine of personal election and final perseverance. And we would particularly note one clause in their preface wherein it is said, our whole design is accomplished if we may obtain that justice as to be measured by our principles and practices and the judgment of both by others according to what we have now published, which the Lord, whose eyes are as a flame of fire, knows to be the doctrine which with our hearts we most firmly believe and sincerely endeavor to conform our lives to. We just read that. Now it's plain that this neither was nor indeed can be spoken of by an assembly that shall admit Seventh-day, now it's written out Sabarians, but it's Sabbatarians, or Arminians among them, the Barbican Church. That can't be the case. You can't hold a confession that way. So my comments here, they express fear that the admission of the Seventh-day Church and the Arminian Church was a direct attempt to undermine the influence of the confession in the associations, and they incorporate letters from Bristol, Bridgnorth, Worcestershire in support of their position. Bristol advised them to remain aloof from this doctrinally compromised group, saying of the confession, we hope it ever shall have a very honorable esteem. The Worcestershire Association, since I grew up in Worcester, I know how to say this word. It's not Worcestershire, it's not Worcestershire. Just think of it as Worcestershire. The Worcestershire Association, 1706. It is proper for the members of the Baptist associations to subscribe the Baptist Confession of Faith, printed 1689, generally owned among us before their admission into said associations, and that the neglect hereof is of dangerous consequence. Dangerous consequence. And let's finish up with Spurgeon. It never hurts to finish up with Spurgeon, who was a Puritan born out of time. To say that a creed comes between a man and his God is to suppose that it's not true. For truth, however definitely stated, does not divide the believer from his Lord. So far as I am concerned, that which I believe I am not ashamed to state in the plainest possible language, and the truth I hold I embrace because I believe it to be the mind of God revealed in his infallible word. How can it divide me from God who revealed it? It is one means of communion with my Lord that I receive his words as well as himself, and submit my understanding to what I see to be taught by him. Say what he may, I accept it because he says it, and therein pay him the humble worship of my inmost soul. It sounds like what the particular Baptist could have written in 1677, doesn't it? Now, I hope that all of this evidence that I've presented to you gives you a helpful understanding of what confessionalism was for the particular Baptist in the 17th century. It was not simply a brief statement of things that we believe, but we have some differences of opinion. Rather, it was to say, invoking the presence of God and the angels and before men who are witnesses, that we really and truly believe these things. We seek, by the help of God's Holy Spirit, to live according to these things. We don't always conform ourselves to them because we're sinners, but with the help of the Lord, we seek to pursue and believe these things. So my argument is that at least among particular Baptists in the 17th century, their view of confessionalism was very high. They had a high view of its place in the church and in the associations, and they were committed to this. Now, if we were to move on into the 18th century, we would see that it's very sad that some men were not as full of integrity as they ought to have been and didn't hold their confessions with the same kind of vigor and commitment. And it was when the churches left in the past the confession and began to treat it as if it's a portrait on the wall, that's when difficulty came. If we came across the pond to the United States, or to the colonies, I guess, better to say, we'd see that's the story in Philadelphia. They adopted the confession of faith. So long as they held to the confession of faith, they maintained their course. But under the influence of John Leland in Virginia, and the amalgamation of the two groups of Baptists in Virginia, the Philadelphia Baptists began to allow the confession of faith to slip away. By the time you come to the middle of the 19th century, you don't have much in the way of confessionalism among the Philadelphia Baptists either. It's a sad story. But that's the charge. They were confessionalists. They were strong confessionalists. In fact, maybe their language was stronger than the language that we use. I've not heard anybody in the 21st century charged with being a hypocrite for not holding to the confession of faith. But that kind of language should say something to us. It should cause us to meditate, to think carefully about what we say and what we believe, remembering that the Lord is always the one who watches over us. Now, I have 5 minutes left. Would anyone like to ask a question? John may be afraid of them. I'm willing to take them right now. Cliff?
One question. Do you have a short answer for what you think might be the reason in the 18th century the Philadelphia Association and Union began to turn from that?
Well, it has a lot to do with the circumstances in Virginia. The Church of England was the dominant church in Virginia, and they were trying to enforce uniformity on the dissenting churches there. And so there was a reaction on the part of the Baptists. You know, you had two kinds of Baptists in Virginia. As the colonies move west, you have the regular Baptists on the coast in the cities, Baltimore, Richmond, Charleston. As you move across the mountains, you get into what's called the separate Baptists, who don't have trained ministers. They're oftentimes farmers. And those are the ones who bore the brunt of persecution, where the Church of England is trying to enforce its doctrine and its practice upon them. So they have this inclination against the enforcement of religious practice, and that enters into their view of what the Confession of Faith does. So John Leland, when he describes the merger of the regulars from the coast and the separates from the inland valleys, he actually calls the regulars wanted the adoption of the Confession of Faith. The separates were against it. They took a long time to debate, and they said, we will generally accept it, but we won't hold anyone to it. And he actually called the confession a Virgin Mary between Christ and his people. You know, use that kind of language. But that's under the influence of the circumstances of the Church of England persecuting the Baptists there. So that's what happened. We probably also can see some Enlightenment thinking coming in. You know, we heard one of them saying that Baptists are congregational and democratic. Well, you're in the run-up to the American Revolution and this whole notion of democracy, independent freedom, at least among the Europeans, here in the colonies. So you have all of those factors working together. John? Good question. In 1845 was when there was a split. Did they hold a confession of faith? I don't know. Jeff?
Isn't it that our confession in the form of that it was published in 1812 in
Charleston?
Wasn't that the widely held confession?
Yes, but it wouldn't have been it wouldn't have been a standard for the Southern Baptist Convention in 1845. It would have been maybe for some of the churches. And it would certainly would have been the most prominent confession up to that point. In fact, in 1881, William Cathcart published the Baptist Encyclopedia, which is an amazing piece of work. But he says something to the effect of all Baptist churches with sense venerate the Articles of 1689. So it still is sort of the theological system that is informing the life of the churches, but it's not held in a strict sense among the churches at all. It's curious, in the Baptist Encyclopedia, you have at that time in 1881, you have a fairly strong free will Baptist movement that's taking root. It's been present in northern New England for a long time. Cathcart can hardly acknowledge the existence of Arminian Baptists in America, which I think is very interesting, that he's unable to even recognize the presence of these people. And I think he overstates the case when he says that the Articles of 1689 are held with veneration. If only that were true. Because within 20 years, fundamentalism is at work, and there's virtually no confessionalism left among Baptists of any kind. So I think he's overly optimistic in what he says. But he still says it in 1881.